It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيه
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: a number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since Sunday rises to 4, as a state of alert is announced in parts of the occupied territory. Political tensions remain high in Pakistan as supporters of ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan hold nationwide protests against his dismissal. And also, results from France's presidential election show incumbent Emmanuel Macron will face far-right leader Marine Le Pen in a runoff vote. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday has risen to 4 amid tensions over a Palestinian retaliatory attack that killed 3 in Tel Aviv last week. A Palestinian teenager succumbed to the injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. He was among the 10 Palestinians injured by Israeli live fire. Regime forces also arrested 20 others. In response, local resistance groups have declared a state of alert to confront Israeli raids. 2 Palestinian women and 1 man were also shot dead across the occupied West Bank on Sunday. One of them, a widowed mother of 6. Palestinians have ramped up their resistance against the regime over the past months. They say this is a legitimate response to Israeli crimes and occupation. Mona Candiel joins us now from Ramallah. Mona, please bring us up to speed on the recent killing that took place in the city of Jenin, and also about the increase of Palestinians being killed by Israelis since that attack that took place in the heart of Tel Aviv.
Well, yes, 4 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli forces in less than 24 hours in the occupied West Bank. 2 were killed in areas near Bethlehem, of course, separate incidents, and a Palestinian woman was killed in Al-Khalil at one of the Israeli military checkpoints. This morning, as you have mentioned, 17-year-old Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to his injuries. Mohammed Zakarni was wounded during the second raid to Jenin. Yesterday, Israeli forces raided Jenin. Israeli undercover units opened fire at a vehicle where the brother of Palestinian martyr who carried out the operation in Tel Aviv, Raed Hazem, the brother, his mother, and his younger brother were inside this vehicle. They were surprised to see Israeli forces. It was not an attempt to arrest them because the Israeli forces opened heavy fire at the vehicle. Mohammed Zakarni, the 17-year-old Palestinian, was there and wounded in this incident. As you have also mentioned, he was among 10 others were wounded. However, he succumbed to his injuries this morning. There are clear orders, let's say, from the Israeli regime. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, during the weekly cabinet meeting yesterday, he praised the Israeli forces and the Israeli military. And he said that the Israeli military and the Israeli security agencies have a free hand to fight terrorism. So they have the green light to use their weapons and to kill Palestinians in cold blood. This is what happened yesterday. A 42-year-old Palestinian woman, a widowed woman, a mother of six, she was trying to go and visit her relatives. The checkpoint was between her house and the house of her relatives. She was surprised to see Israeli soldiers pointing their weapons at her. They ordered her to stop, and they fired towards her. She was terrified. She raised her hands, but she didn't stop. She was screaming because she was surprised. The Israeli forces immediately opened fire at her and killed her. Then later, they said they didn't find any weapon with her. Yesterday, there were clashes, heavy clashes in Al-Khadr near Bethlehem. 21-year-old Palestinian man was shot in the back. So it's not Israeli forces shooting Palestinians to disperse, let's say, protesters. No, they are using their weapon in order to kill Palestinians in cold blood. It could be seen, according to experts, as, let's say, killing in cold blood and intended to kill Palestinians. The situation in Jenin is still tense, with the Palestinian resistance groups have said that they will not allow the Israeli forces to raid Jenin and to kill people without doing anything. So the different Palestinian resistance groups have declared their unity and that they would fight the Israeli forces.
Thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Hours after the ouster of Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, his supporters take to the streets to express opposition to the parliamentary no-confidence vote against him. Thousands of people rallied in different Pakistani cities. They held placards and chanted slogans in support of Khan's party, Tehreek-e-Insaf. The protesters called the dismissed prime minister the choice of the people. Khan was unseated on Sunday after a day-long impasse in parliament. Finally, the opposition secured a majority vote in support of a no-confidence motion against him. He's accused of political and economic failures, but says he has fallen victim to a U.S.-backed regime change plot. Pakistan's parliament is meeting later Monday to elect a new prime minister. Opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif is the likely candidate to replace Khan. And now to the presidential election in France. Vote counting has begun across the country amid a low voter turnout. Partial results show incumbent president Emmanuel Macron is ahead of far-right contender Marine Le Pen. Macron has scored more than 27% of the vote, while Le Pen has gained over 25.5%. That means the election will go to a runoff with the two top contenders facing off on April the 24th. Meanwhile, Macron said nothing is decided yet, urging citizens not to vote for Le Pen when the two go head-to-head in the next round. In a speech to supporters, Macron said he would reach out to all who want to work for France. He added France and Europe are at a decisive stage. In the meantime, Le Pen said heal France's divisions if elected president.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat.
Now everything begins. We need to explain the project we had for the five coming years with the president, because the president was not in a position to completely explain his project. He was at work for the French people because of the Ukrainian crisis.
In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and LaSalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
The World Bank has forecast a bleak economic outlook for Ukraine and the region amid Russia's military operation in the country. In a report, the bank predicted that Ukraine's economy will collapse by more than 45% this year. The projected figure is far worse than the 10 to 35% downturn the International Monetary Fund predicted last month. The bank added that Russia will also see a more than 11% decline in its GDP. The World Bank said the entire region is suffering from economic consequences as a result of the war, adding the conflict has caused prices of grains and energy to shoot up as well. The Washington-based institution reiterated that this is the second major shock to hit the regional economy in 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic. The United States has reaffirmed commitment to supplying arms to Ukraine in its ongoing conflict with Russia. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said his country will provide Ukraine with weapons it needs so that it will be able to beat back Russia. Sullivan added Washington has been working round the clock to deliver such weapons. That's why the Ukrainian president has expressed skepticism that Washington would arm Kiev in a way it has vowed to do. In an interview with CBS News, Vladimir Zelensky said he doesn't have the confidence that his country will be receiving the much-needed arms. He also called on the EU to impose more sanctions on Moscow. In a telephone conversation with the German chancellor, Zelensky demanded embargo on Russian oil and gas. Germany has so far resisted doing so due to its heavy reliance on Russian energy. However, Germany's gas imports from Russia have been cut by around 15%. The United Nations says over 4.5 million Ukrainians have fled their country since the start of Russia's offensive in late February. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities don't allow men of military age to leave the country. A further 7.1 million people are said to be internally displaced. The UN also says over 200,000 non-Ukrainians have fled over the past 2 months. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. Romania, Moldova, and Hungary are among other countries witnessing an influx of Ukrainian refugees. Europe is facing its biggest refugee crisis since World War II. The Russian Human Rights Commissioner confirms that Moscow and Kiev have carried out another prisoner exchange despite an ongoing conflict between the two neighbors. Tatiana Moskalkova says four employees of Russia's Atomic Energy Corporation have returned home from Ukraine. According to the commissioner, some Russian soldiers and civilians have also been freed. The move includes the release of a number of Russian and Ukrainian truck drivers as well. Ukraine has confirmed the latest prisoner swap. The deputy prime minister says a dozen Ukrainian soldiers and 14 civilians have been freed as part of the prisoner swap. This was the third exchange of soldiers and civilians held by Kiev and Moscow since the start of the conflict. Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract, adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing cost of living. Here's a look.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten.
In the midst of the pandemic, the Prime Minister himself said we won't forget about the nurses. The truth is that they have forgotten about us. We were expecting a pay raise considering the challenges and the suffering we had to go through during the pandemic. Negotiations are underway for the contractual renewal of the health sector. Let's see how it unfolds.
About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst-hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Ramazan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Fasting is among the worships which God had prescribed in the religions before Islam. He says in Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah that fasting has been prescribed for Muslims as it had been prescribed for those before. Fasting in general means abstaining from eating and drinking. It is a kind of austerity for body in order for spirit to grow and reach perfection. If you remember, we discussed fasting among Jews, and today we are going to touch upon fasting among Christians. Stay tuned, please. Fasting is observed differently among different sects of Christianity. Most Christians believe in 40 days of fasting before Easter. This period is called Lent and is devoted to fasting and penitence. It is the period from Ash Wednesday to Easter Eve. Faithful Christians abstain from certain things and repent from sins in this period. They avoid eating fruits, egg, meat, and dairy, and spend their time in prayer and worship. Catholics maintain the period begins on the day in which Prophet Jesus fled the plot of the Romans and went to the wilderness. They fast till Saturday after crucifixion of Jesus on Friday. Catholics used to repent and abstain from eating meat on Fridays for centuries, but in mid-1960s, abstaining from eating meat was announced voluntary except the days of Lent. The Orthodox Christians observe different periods of fasting besides Lent. They include the fasting of apostles, the day of Lady Mary's ascension to heavens, and the birthday of Jesus. The Orthodox Church considers all Wednesdays and Fridays as fasting day except the weeks in which fasting is not obligatory. Fasting in this sect includes abstaining from eating meat, dairy, and egg. Fish is permitted in some days, while it is forbidden in others. In Protestantism, however, fasting depends on the individuals, organizations, and Christian communities. Some of them completely abstain from water and food, while others permit drinking and eating certain foods. They abstain from eating one or several meals. Although there are differences among Christian sects in the way of fasting, the aim of fasting is the same. Struggling satanic temptations, avoiding any kind of evil, and purifying the heart for God. Christian leaders used to persuade people to pay attention to the inward of fasting rather than the appearance. Perhaps one of the reasons of differences among Christian sects in the matter of fasting has been to draw the attention to the inward of fasting. In the Gospel of Matthew, verses 16 to 18, it has been said that Prophet Jesus recommends his disciples not to be double-faced like hypocrites while they are fasting. He advises the disciples not to feign sadness like hypocrites. Jesus tells them to wash their faces and comb their hair so that no one is aware of their fasting. This way, God will reward them as he is aware of whatever people do. As Christian leaders and central churches did not pay due attention to a specific system for fasting, this worship has not been taken seriously and at times has been nullified. Christian historian Dionysius Iskandarani points to the fasting of Holy Week, in which
people eat nothing. Others fast 2 days, another group fasts for 4 days, and a fourth group does not care at all. Excessive attention to the inward of worships in Christianity alongside other social factors have caused disorder in fasting and led to a kind of perversion. This perversion is monasticism, which had not existed and has been innovated. Monasticism is called Rahbaniya in the Quran. It means fear and seclusion from people for worship of God. This practice was innovated in Christianity to accelerate reaching God, but it turned into excessive austerity. Astounding events have been mentioned in the history about the life of monks. For example, monk Macarius didn't eat meat for 7 years, didn't sleep for 20 nights, and exposed his body to the poisonous stings of insects. Other monks used to carry heavy loads and chain their feet and hands. Of course, there are such practices in some other religions, but God definitely does not like these acts. Principally, proximity of God is attainable only through living among people. One should live with people while trying to reform the society and help people in their hardships. Moreover, we are not allowed to torment our body. The blessed month of Ramadan is the ground for refining the inward and outward to enjoy the divine mercy. As it has been mentioned several times, getting accustomed to the Quran and pondering on its teachings will pave the way for expurgation of the heart and getting close to God. O God, greet Muhammad and his progeny and place us among those who cling to the cord of the Quran and find calm with it. Amen.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organization, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the US-engineered regime change plot in Pakistan and how Prime Minister Imran Khan thwarted the hideous move. And we shall take a look at political tensions in India, whipped up by a new film that manipulates the truth and portrays Muslims as evil and treacherous.
Regime change plotters were again at it, and they were once again forced to eat humble pie. More than 3 years after assuming power, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan faced the biggest challenge of his political career just recently, with the cricketer-turned-politician clearly outsmarted his internal rivals and external foes. The country's parliament dismissed the no-trust motion against him on the 1st of April, calling it unconstitutional. It asserted that no foreign power will be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy.
After weeks of animated political activity, Pakistan's parliament on Sunday, April the 3rd, rejected the opposition's move to topple the government of Imran Khan. National Assembly Deputy Speaker Qasim Khan Suri said the resolution could not be voted upon as it was supported by foreign elements and violated Article 5 of the country's constitution. In a televised speech later, Khan reiterated that the move to overthrow him was a foreign conspiracy. President Arif Alvi then dissolved parliament at the Prime Minister's request and asked the nation to prepare for a fresh election. Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf leader thus failed to complete his full term, a feat no prime minister has been able to accomplish in the country's turbulent history. Before the high-drama vote, the embattled premier had rejected calls from political rivals to resign, claiming a foreign regime change plot behind the move. The opposition has accused the parliament deputy speaker of committing an unconstitutional act by rejecting the no-confidence vote against the prime minister. Pakistan People's Party chief Bilawal Bhutto said the opposition will stage a sit-in until the no-trust vote is held. Now all eyes are on the country's Supreme Court and the military.
Imran Khan's claim of foreign meddling in Pakistan's internal affairs was no bluff. Americans have resorted to the hideous regime change playbook in many countries. Khan and his ministers cited a letter by a senior U.S. government official as proof of a U.S. conspiracy to overthrow the PTI government. The trigger apparently was Khan's recent visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis, his refusal to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine, as well as his freewheeling criticism of America's botched military exit from Afghanistan.
In a televised address last week, Prime Minister Khan referred to a threatening letter received by Pakistan's outgoing ambassador to Washington, Asad Majid Khan, from a senior U.S. State Department official. The letter was sent to Islamabad on March the 7th, a day before Pakistan's opposition made the first move to push a no-trust motion against Khan in Parliament. The letter warned that U.S.-Pakistan relations will not improve with Khan in power, and that Pakistan will be forgiven once he is ousted. Khan called it the evidence of an international conspiracy to topple his government. Khan and his aides linked the threat to his late February visit to Moscow, the first by a Pakistani premier in 23 years. The timing of the visit, hours before the Kremlin launched a military operation in Ukraine, and his refusal to join the Western bloc in condemning the operation at the UN General Assembly, turned him into a villain.
We hear a long history of excellent
and strategic relationship with the United States, which remains our largest export market. We seek to broaden and expand our ties with both countries without impacting our relations with the other.
He also lashed out at the European Union for asking him to vote against Russia at the UN, saying they shouldn't treat Pakistan as their slave. So it's pretty clear the move to overthrow him was aided and abetted in foreign shores.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Musharraf Husseini, an Islamic scholar, political commentator and director of Justice Peace London. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Husseini. Now let's begin with Imran Khan surviving the no-trust motion against him in the parliament and that he still won't be able to serve the full term. So how do you see this political crisis unfolding in coming weeks and months?
He has survived this time, but the thing is that we need to go into the background and see the background, what happens here. In Pakistan, we have the governments which are always listening to Americans, and it's a long time. The story started with our previous president in Field Marshal Ayub Khan, and he also wrote down a book, Friends Not Masters, because America was trying to become the master of Pakistan. And although he was invited to America and he had a great reception there and reception in America. But later on, we see that at the time of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the same thing was being tried. And in the last days of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto as a prime minister, we see he showed a letter which was sent from America, and he wanted to show the proof of Americans. And he said that the white elephant is after me. And then he was taken out of power. And then Ziaul-Haq came. And Ziaul-Haq also ended up in a blast, in this aeroplane was blasted. And people, it's an open secret that people point finger towards the United States about that. And later on, the governments, one after another, there was a musical chairs between Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, and all that stuff was going on. And one after another, everyone was looking towards the dictations from America. Imran Khan is the one who has come after a long time in Pakistan, where he is not listening to the dictations. He's not that type of man to listen to the dictations. He has been playing in the West, and he's familiar with the Western culture.
Now, Mr. Husseini, Prime Minister Khan and his aides have claimed that foreign conspiracy is behind the move to topple his government, blasting the U.S. for ganging up with his political opponents. Now, do you also see the regime change plot?
Yeah, regime change is not a new phenomenon for Americans. We have been going through the Arab Spring, and after that, we saw too many changes there. It was a phenomenon which was brought in by Americans, and they wanted to bring in changes because they're puppets in the Middle East. They were getting outdated, and they were getting old enough to remain. And there was resentment about them in the public. So they brought in the Arab Spring, and when the governments which came in, they were not according to their wishes. Like in Egypt and in other places, they just Morsi came in, and they had to take out Morsi through his other proxies, through Saudis and United Arab Emirates. They played a role in taking them off. Then there was a regime change in revolutions, like in Poland and other places. They brought in the revolutions and to bring in the leaders of their choices there. And moreover, we now see the latest developments that happened, what happened in Libya, or in Iraq, or in other places. That's very obvious. The Americans were involved in all those regime changes, and it has become a part of their policy now. So sometimes they do it by force, like for Saddam, what they did. Sometimes they do it politically by bringing in revolutions, and sometimes Pakistan, because Pakistani governments for years, they have been subservient to the American policy and American dictates. So now they have got enough people in the Pakistani system, so they wanted to take put them in and give them the duty of bringing in the change. So I'm very sure, in my opinion, whatever is happening, and which is, it's very obvious that Americans were trying, the American government was trying to bring in the change. Afterward, Imran Khan became with an independent foreign policy, and looking towards east, and then having good relations with China, with Russia, with Iran, and with other neighbors, and talking about Islamic thing.
Thank you for being on the program, Mr. Hosseini. Now let's see how people on social media had to say on America's push for regime change in Pakistan.
Hossein Nadeem, executive director at the Islamabad Policy Research Institute, calls regime change and interference in foreign countries a recorded and proven fact, demanding a probe into foreign conspiracy against Imran Khan's government. Minister of Human Rights in Imran Khan's cabinet, Shirin Mazari, says those who pushed the no-trust motion against Khan in parliament were part of an international conspiracy, but the plot was thwarted. Masood Ehsan Bhatti, a Lahore-based university student who notes that the top U.S. diplomat behind the move to overthrow Imran Khan's government did not deny allegations during his recent India visit.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The latest Bollywood blockbuster, The Kashmir Files, is creating ripples in India and racking up record box office sales. It's not a romantic thriller or a biopic drama, but Gobble-style filmmaking that whips up empathy for one side and malice for the other. To invoke critics, it's not even filmmaking, but myth-making at its best. Based on the exodus of Hindus from Kashmir in the late 1980s, the film shows Muslims as villains and Hindus as their helpless victims, thereby providing a distorted vision of history.
Kashmir Files, a movie that claims to chronicle the exodus of Hindus from the Muslim-majority region of Indian-controlled Kashmir between 1989 and 1990, has kicked up a political storm in India. Instead of a fair and accurate portrayal of the tragic episode, the film presents a distorted trajectory of events. It paints Kashmiri Muslims as extraordinarily savage, accusing them of engineering the exodus. It also manages to vilify Muslims in mainland India, showing them as dangerous vultures preying on vulnerable Hindus. The controversial film has whipped up hate against Indian Muslims, with videos on social media showing people who watched it calling Muslims traitors and encouraging Hindus to exterminate them. That's what a distorted cinematic portrayal of historical events can do. Staggering box office numbers and Twitter hashtags are never the barometers of a film's success, but its ability to unite people and heal them are. This film has aggravated the religious discord and hatred in an already polarized Indian society, where marginalization of Muslims has become a mainstream political discourse. The film has been promoted by the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, with many BJP-ruled states making it tax-free. That, experts believe, sets a dangerous precedent in Indian cinema.
The film The Kashmir Files seeks to mainstream the false propaganda about the exodus of Hindus from the Kashmir Valley. It claims to reveal the truth that there was genocide against them engineered by Muslims and that thousands of them were killed in cold blood. Muslims in mainland India are portrayed in the film as inherently evil, demonic and predatory, justifying the brazen Hindu extremism that has been normalized under the BJP rule. That's precisely why the top BJP leadership has gone out of its way to promote the film.
While the movie, made by far-right filmmaker Vivek Agnihotri, claims that thousands of Hindus were massacred in Kashmir, official estimates reveal a completely different picture. Kashmir police in a recent memo claimed that only 89 Hindus were killed in the Kashmir Valley since January 1990. India's Home Ministry in December 2017 stated that 174 cases of killing of Kashmiri Hindus had been registered. In March 2010, Kashmir's Legislative Assembly was informed that 219 Kashmiri Hindus were killed since 1989. In contrast, thousands of Kashmiri Muslims have been killed over the past three decades, many of them lying in unmarked mass graves. The film also resorts to the trope employed by radical Hindu groups in India to attack Muslims, alleging a conspiracy by Muslim men to lure Hindu women into wedlock to numerically overtake Hindus. The conspiracy theory has been widely used to justify violence against Muslims in recent years. As critics and historians have stressed, the film's storyline isn't even remotely close to what actually happened in Kashmir. Why it's being talked about is because the ruling party, which thrives from divisive politics and misses no opportunity to push its communal agenda, has endorsed the film.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shiva Sundar, an activist and a freelance journalist from Bangalore City. Welcome to the program, sir. As we've seen, the new Bollywood film, The Kashmir Files, has witnessed phenomenal box office success despite controversies. With this in mind, could we say myth-making sells more than filmmaking in India today?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The myth-making and mystifying the realities are always the blackbusters in the Bollywood movie. But there is something else to this particular movie. The runaway hit is not only because of the interest shown by the audience, it is also manipulated and mobilized. This is a Bollywood hit people have shown in their interest in the theme of the movie, but also because it has acquired the state support. Almost some 20 to 30 states within the Indian country have declared tax-free shows, and the ruling party, that is Bharatiya Janata Party, which rules at the center and in almost 16 states of this country, have actually mobilized the people in a big way. There is a kind of, it was a kind of a party program to actually hire the cinema theaters for days and weeks and to show the movie, because it actually helps the propaganda and the political agenda of the ruling party. So there is a two part to this runaway success. One is the general interest in the theme of the movie, because it is about the Kashmiri Pandits. Kashmiri Pandits have not made into the theme of the movies for a long time. But just a year before, there was another movie on the same subject by name Shikara, but it did not fit well into the political interpretation of the ruling party, so it did not get any kind of support or the media support from the established medias of this country. But this particular movie, Kashmiri Files, talks about the Kashmiri Pandits and how it was actually, it is not about even Kashmiri Pandits in that way. The very name is very confusing, because Kashmiri Files in that way means that it is the story of the people of the Kashmir. That way, it is not the story of the all the people of the Kashmir. It is only Pandits who are actually the protagonists here. And not even the story of the real story of the Pandits, because many Kashmiri Pandits who now live in the refugee camps in the Jammu part of the Jammu Kashmir state have denied the many scenes and the running story.
Sir, the film, which is based on the exodus of Hindus from Kashmir Valley three decades ago, claims that thousands of them were killed. Official figures tell a different story. Now, could you shed some light on the real truth?
Yes, see, generally when there is a situation of kind of controversy and war, the basic casualty is facts and the truth. In fact, it is true that there was a big exodus of Kashmiri Pandits from the valley in 1990, starting from January 19th of 1990 to, say, March or April. But the number is very much exaggerated, because very recently, say, last year in 2021, on November 27, there was an application filed by a citizen of this country to the right to according to the Right to Information Act that is passed in this country, we can seek any official information from the any offices of this government. Likewise, there was a information, there was an application seeking information about the number of terrorists who are killed by the number of Pandits who are killed by the terrorists between January 1990 to till date. The answer given, the official answer, let me also tell you that since 2019 August 5, the Jammu Kashmir state is under the central rule, presidential rule. That means it is Modi government. So then the DGP of the Jammu Kashmir state gives information saying that between January 19th of 1990 and 2021 November, altogether 1,722 civilians are killed, out of which only 89 are Kashmir Pandits. Rest are non-Pandits and most of them happen to be the Muslims. This is the real story. It is not to say that Kashmiri Pandits were not killed. It is not to say that there was a big anxiety among the Kashmiri Pandits that their lives will be under jeopardy if they continue to live in the valley. But the way it is portrayed as if it was a big holocaust is not true, because till the whole 30 years, according to the government information itself, it is only 89 Pandits who are killed, and each and every life is actually important. Even 89 is a big number in that sense. But the other part of the story is that the target of the terrorists were not religious targets, because more people who were killed by the terrorists in this period, civilians who were killed by the terrorists, are Muslims.
Now, the top leadership of the Hindu nationalist ruling party in India, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has endorsed the film. So it seems that it serves the BJP's divisive communal agenda.
Of course, it's not only Narendra Modi, right from Narendra Modi to many BJP chief ministers ruling different states and all the BJP organizations and the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the ideological guru of the ruling dispensation, and their organizations, they have all endorsed the movie and they have said that this is the complete truth and this helps them in a big way. Because what is the lie that is concocted by this ruling government? It is to say that except BJP, no government was actually considering the plight of the Pandits in the Jammu, in the Kashmir Valley. And Kashmiri Muslims, the whole Kashmiri Muslims, are pro-Pakistan and anti-national. And this is the story actually right from 1953. The BJP's earlier avatar was Bharatiya Janasangh. The founder of Bharatiya Janasangh was Shyam Prasad Mukherjee. Since 1953, it is the story that is being dished out to the people of this country that every person, 90 lakh Muslims who are living in the Kashmiri Valley, are pro-Pakistan and are helping the terrorists. And it is only under the Modi regime that Kashmir is completely integrated into India, and Article 370 was a big hurdle, which is actually Congress and other ruling parties helped the Kashmiri Valley to disassociate with Kashmir, with India. But this is again half-truth, because Article 370 was completely accepted by the Constitution Assembly of India, wherein Shyam Prasad Mukherjee was also a member. Sardar Patel, whom the BJP government hold in high reverence, was also the member.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Shiva Sundar for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A columnist at Toronto Star, Shri Paradkar, blasts the makers of new Bollywood film Kashmir Files, saying the distortion of true events in the film was eliciting strong visceral reactions from Hindus against Muslims. Rana Ayub, a prominent Indian journalist and Washington Post columnist, blames the Hindu nationalist BJP government and Prime Minister Narendra Modi for promoting, propagating and facilitating a film that has amplified hate against Muslims in India. A senior journalist with Telegraph newspaper, Sanjay K. Jha, cites Indian politician and former minister Sharad Pawar as saying that the BJP was creating a poisonous atmosphere by spreading false propaganda through films like Kashmir Files.
And that was our episode about the US bid to topple the Imran Khan government in Pakistan, and also films being used as a political tool to stoke communal tensions and divisions in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
An investigation has found the British charity Thinking Autism promoted unproven autism treatments in testimonials on its website and directed families to clinicians linked to Andrew Wakefield, a British anti-vaccine activist, former physician and discredited academic who was struck off the medical register for his involvement in the Lancet MMR autism fraud. We'll prepare for you an article written by Shanti Das. The piece is titled Revealed, Autism Charity Chief Has Links to Anti-Vaccine Movement in UK. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. British autism charity that received hundreds of thousands of pounds in national lottery funds.